if we were to use the term serial, I mean, it would not have protected your safety. It would not have changed people to stop going on the trail.
Anchorage police respond to public frustration over limited information on recent homicides. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Bill Walker selects a new chief of staff.
I like to facilitate decision-making to the right person at the right time, and I've always kind of been able to bring people together to, I think, get to the right solution.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A day after news that five Anchorage murders are linked to the same gun used in an officer-involved shooting over the weekend, questions remain about how officials responded to public concerns in the months before. Law enforcement had very little evidence connecting the homicides, and as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, police walked a fine line between recruiting the public's help and not losing their only threads in the case.
Anchorage police caught a break. They've known since July that the same gun was used in multiple homicides, but even as more killings happened, that's almost all they knew. So when Lieutenant John McKinnon arrived at a crime scene early Saturday morning, it was a huge surprise to find the exact weapon they'd been looking for.
Immediately recognized that there was a Colt Python. It made me tickle pink a little bit.
The Colt Python 357 is a revolver, and McKinnon says it's rare nowadays to see those in Anchorage homicide cases. Months before, the state's crime lab had connected the weapon to five killings from this summer before 40-year-old James Dale Ritchie used it against an APD officer downtown during an early morning stop that had nothing to do with the open investigations. McKinnon says that as of right now, investigators only have evidence tying Ritchie to the death of 21-year-old Trayvon Kendall Thompson in July, not the two double homicides from this summer.
We know that the weapon was used on those other two cases, but we haven't discovered complete information to show that Mr. Ritchie was there. I mean, it would be a speculation.
Right now, McKinnon says the department's focus is finding proof that it was Ritchie who shot the other four victims in order to close the case. Going forward, APD will work with partners like the Federal Bureau of Investigation to see if Ritchie is linked to other cases elsewhere in the country, but says that there aren't any other investigations in Anchorage where he's a suspect right now. APD is not calling Ritchie a serial killer, partly out of deference to process, since he hasn't been factually linked to other homicides, but also out of concerns over messaging. And that was a decision they made this summer, even after the department began realizing that random murders did have something in common.
If we were to use the term serial, I mean, it would not have protected your safety. It would not have changed people to stop going on the trails. And there was no investigative benefit to put that out there. And we didn't want to embolden the person.
This is a point of local controversy. For months, members of the media and the public have asked law enforcement and elected officials whether some of this year's record-breaking homicides were the work of one predatory individual. And for months, the police department has said they will not speculate on open cases, a response which many have found vague and unsatisfactory. Communications Director Jennifer Castro says APD has been trying to find a balance between keeping the public informed enough to be safe without jeopardizing a fragile investigation.
That gun is the only piece of evidence that we had to tie any of these cases together. If that gun were to go away, to disappear, to get dumped, we would have no way to tie any of this together.
This is not a theoretical concern for investigators. Besides the gun, police had just enough clues in one of the homicide cases to release a sketch of the suspect and a description of a yellow bike they believed Ritchie stole from one of his victims. According to McKinnon, interviews and material on Ritchie's recovered phone show he got rid of the bike after that was made public. Stacey Fager-Pelissier is a spokesperson for the FBI in Anchorage and says in cases like these, police departments are trying to balance public concerns against what effect additional information will have on investigations.
I can understand the public's concern, but we also need to understand the difference between wanting to know something and needing to know something. And in this case, releasing additional information would have jeopardized the investigation and could have possibly led to even more murders.
But that logic doesn't assuage concerns from the last few months felt by many Anchorage residents. Eric Croft sits on the assembly and says there's been a tension between the interests of police investigators and members of the public.
I had a number of constituents and other Anchorage residents trying to figure out whether we had a serial killer, whether these crimes were connected. I mean, people are naturally concerned about that.
Those fears led to chatter on social media, alarmed public meetings, and even organizing in some areas to start community patrols. And it changed a lot of people's behaviors and feelings about where they live. Eva Gardner lives near Valley of the Moon, where a double homicide in August has been linked to the gun in question. Gardner wrote a letter to the mayor after the killings, saying the city's response to residents' concerns had been inadequate. She says, like a lot of people, she heeded warnings from the police department to avoid the city's trails out of concerns for safety.
After the Valley of the Moon homicides, I still walked to work as long as it was daylight, but as soon as the darkness came, I stopped using them alone. And I think as of this week, I'm going to start using them again.
Gardner says that's a sentiment she's heard from others as well. She feels relief that investigators believe the man responsible for this summer's killings is no longer a threat, but sees room for improvement in how police communicate with citizens. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Governor Bill Walker named a new chief of staff today, bringing in Anchorage lawyer Scott Kendall to replace Jim Whitaker. Kendall says he'll be like a basketball point guard for Walker's team, helping the administration achieve its goals.
I don't need to be the smartest person in the room, but I like to facilitate decision-making to the right person at the right time. And I've always kind of been able to bring people together to, I think, get to the right solution.
Kendall has worked as an attorney and consultant for all three current members of Alaska's congressional delegation. He also worked for Senator Ted Stevens. His most recent job included coordinating U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's re-election campaign. He also worked with state-level politicians, including Walker's election campaign, and worked for Anchorage Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. He says he works well across party lines.
I'm a Republican. My wife is a Democrat. We agree on 95% of everything. It's real simple, and we're Alaskans first.
Whitaker will continue to work for Walker on a project to provide natural gas to the interior and other initiatives. NOAA Fisheries announced today they have concluded the listing of Pacific Harbor seals in Iliamna Lake as an endangered or threatened species under the Endangered Species Act is not warranted. The state of Alaska concurs with this decision. Julie Spiegel is the spokesperson for NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region.
We found that to be a distinct population segment, the species must be both discrete and significant to the taxon to which it belongs. After careful scientific review of the best information available, NOAA Fisheries found that the harbor seals found in Iliamna Lake are discrete from Pacific harbor seal subspecies, but they are not significant to it, and therefore they are not eligible for listing under the Endangered Species Act.
The review was conducted in response to a petition by the Center for Biological Diversity. In their petition, the center raised concern that seals in the lake face threats from climate change, ocean acidification, and from pebble project development. Spiegel says while these seals are not protected by the Endangered Species Act, they are still protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, state budget cuts slash a treatment program for sex offenders.
When you've got a program that is really working, it's a shame they can't find a way to get the funds to keep the program going.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Anchorage Assembly passed a $504 million operating budget during its meeting last night. That total is up slightly from last year, with increases going primarily to pay for a larger police force. Modest cuts were made across the board to departmental budgets, grant programs, and public transportation. The budget passed 7-4, with conservative Assembly members opposed because they say it grows the size of local government amid a lean fiscal environment. The Assembly also approved four new cannabis businesses within the municipality. They include two retail shops and a manufacturing facility in the Anchorage Bowl, as well as a shop in Girdwood that shares a location with a laundromat. However, the body voted to postpone weighing in on a local permit for Arctic Herbery. The business was on track to be the first pot shop in Anchorage, but it came under fire when state investigators found evidence that marijuana had been given away on the premise. Although state officials took no action against the owner, the Assembly opted to postpone a decision on the permit until early December. State budget cuts have reduced Bethel's sex offender treatment program to a fraction of its former self. The program staff has gone from three members with a combined experience of almost 40 years to one member with 4 months' experience. Now, board members, former employees, and advocates are saying the change is too much too soon. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports they fear recidivism will increase, costing the state more money down the line and producing more victims along the way.
Mike Gray is the Bethel District Attorney. He regularly sees sex offenders and victims in the courtroom and was one of several community members who wrote letters to Governor Walker protesting the program cuts.
I mean, it's a tailor-made program for the YK Delta. And I just hate to see it founder because of a lack of funding.
Since the Bethel Sex Offender Treatment Program began in 2008, 180 men have completed the program and only three have reoffended. That's a recidivism rate of 1.7%, less than the state average of 3 to 5% for sex offenders. Credit for the program's success may be due to it having been created specifically for the Delta, using UPIC values and culture as its foundation. Besides regular counseling sessions, the men hunt and fish and donate the meat to the Tundra Women's Coalition, the local women and children shelter. They also donate meat to their victims' families when it's accepted. The program sets up what they call safety nets. That's five people in the offender's community who knows the person's offenses, their triggers, and watches them when they return. The program also assembles victim impact panels. Victims and people who work with victims meet with offenders and tell their stories of what it's like to survive an assault or respond to a scene. Now, the program's community advisory board and supporters, like Gray, fear all that work will go away.
I understand tough economic times, but when you've got a program that is really working, it's a shame that they can't find a way to get the funds to keep the program going. And I just hate to see it fall apart, which is what I'm afraid is going to happen.
Two mental health clinicians started the program, Steve Dempsey and Joan Dewey. Dempsey supervised and came to the program with more than 20 years' experience working with sex offenders. For many years, a UPIC-speaking case manager worked with them. Last year, Joan Dewey retired. In July of 2016, the state hired a replacement clinician with no background treating sex offenders. In October, Dempsey's contract ended and wasn't renewed. Funding for the case manager ran out about the same time. Now, the entire program is being run by one clinician with 4 months' experience treating sex offenders. Her supervisor is in Juneau. The cuts were made to help bring the Department of Corrections out of the red, after lawmakers reduced the department's budget by more than $8.5 million. Dempsey's contract cost just over $250,000 annually. He didn't live in Bethel, and that included his salary, per diem, and airfare from Ketchikan every 2 weeks. The current clinician is being paid less than half that, just under $100,000. DOC spokesman Corey Allen Young says the savings made sense.
In light of the financial situation we're in, we can do it a lot cheaper and still have the same results. That's what we're going to do.
And what if you don't have those same results?
I mean, it's just like with anything. You always look at ways to improve, and the bottom goal, again, is successful transition, you know, for our inmates when they're inside the institution and when they get out.
That's exactly what the board doesn't think will happen. Going so quickly from decades of clinical experience with multiple staff to 4 months' experience with one person. The DOC expects to save just under $17,000 per participant. They want to use the savings to continue the subsistence portion of the program and encourage community involvement. Gray, the Bethel District Attorney, says if recidivism rises, the costs of prosecuting, imprisoning, and treating reoffenders will far outweigh any initial savings, and the cost to communities and victims, irreparable and immeasurable.
Being victimized trails and haunts victims for decades. And if you can avoid one, I mean, what's the cost of avoiding one victim? What's the cost of avoiding two victims? What's the cost of avoiding three victims? I mean, how do you measure that?
The Community Advisory Board for the Bethel Sex Offender Treatment Program meets at 12 noon today at the Moravian Church to discuss the changes. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A North Pole school will get a new name. The Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Board of Education approved a measure last night to rename Badger Road Elementary. The road is named after a North Pole area pioneer who pleaded guilty to child rape a century ago. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the name has long since transcended any connection to the man.
Local farmer Harry Badger pled guilty to raping a 10-year-old girl in 1916, but the crime faded in public memory.
Somehow was remembered later in his life as being a great guy, so much so that he was elected to the legislature, had all sorts of things named after him.
North Star Borough Board of Education member and attorney Michael Bryan brought the Badger name's connection to the admitted pedophile back into the local public consciousness this summer, leading up to the school board's consideration of a renaming measure. O'Brien explained his motivation to the board and recounted a 1916 newspaper story quote from Badger's attorney,
where he said that the little girl in question had told another little girl, and that that little girl had told her mother, and that this woman told the mother of the unfortunate child, and that the two mothers went to Mr. Badger and he admitted it. That's a line from 1916. It could be a line from 2016.
The historic facts aside, many in the Badger Road area community oppose the name change. North Pole resident Sherry Renson testified before the board that the Badger name has become far removed from the man and is more about the community.
Badger is a common name for many businesses that are or originally located in the Badger Road area. Badger Gas, Northern Lights Badger Lions. They have a playground right across the street from Badger Gas. Badger Glass, Badger Towing.
Renson noted that Harry Badger's criminal past was discussed when the school was named in 1982 and that it was specifically changed to reflect the road, not the man. Phyllis Teagan Alexander of Fairbanks said she sympathizes with people whose sense of place is tied to the name, but testified that there are victims of rape in the community and the Badger name should not be on a school.
What does that tell our children? That their victimization is nothing? It's to be brushed aside? I don't care if it happened 100 years ago.
Quite honestly, I can't stand by idly and allow us to continue to honor someone that's convicted of raping a child.
School board member and local Army Colonel Sean Williams said the issue comes down to morality. Another school board member, Sean Rice, whose kids attended Badger Road Elementary, said he served on the PTA and now the school board to give voice to North Pole and other outlying communities that have a history of not being listened to by the school district.
And that is where all the conflict is coming from right now. Because a lot of us who have been out in the Badger Road area for years are tired having things done to us without being heard.
Rice was the only board member to vote against the measure to rename the school. A committee will be appointed to choose a new name. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The city of Emonic remains without its sewer and water after a fire. KYUK's Adrian Wagner reports efforts are underway to improve the situation.
The Emonic City Council Tuesday night approved a proposal to start repairs on its crippled sewage treatment plant, which caught fire on Monday. The council approved $20,000 to fix the roof of the plant, a first step, which has to be done before replacing a burned-out pump, which is what caused the fire. City Manager Martin Moore says that this cannot wait.
The immediate problem is the families. The families need to have a potable water. They need to flush the toilets and they need to flush the water from the bathtub and showers to the lagoon.
The City Council did act quickly, approving Moore's proposal to enter into a contract with Rich Contracting Incorporated, which was already doing work on the plant at the time of the blaze. The contractor estimates 3 days to fix the roof, but Moore says the whole operation could be out of commission for weeks, and this worries him a lot.
If the repair work for the vacuum pump is not done in time, it is possible that the pipes at the west end of town and the east end of town, which provides close to 300 homes, will probably freeze, and if it freezes, it'll become a major disaster.
Moore guesses it could take months to fix if this happens, and then there would be another problem.
We don't have any money to repair the damages if that were to happen.
Moore says it could cost over $1 million, and the village would have to go to the state for help.
We would have to declare an emergency disaster.
Emonic has gotten some relief already from the Alaska Native Health Consortium, $5,000 for the roof, and they've requested help from the Rasmussen Foundation. Moore just hopes it will come in time. In Emonic, I'm Adrian Wagner.
Two Alaskans charged with starting the destructive Sockeye wildfire over a year ago will face trial starting late this month. According to Palmer District Attorney Eric Senta, trial proceedings start November 29th at the State Courthouse in Palmer. The state of Alaska is seeking an acknowledgement of criminal negligence and an acceptance of responsibility on the part of the two defendants. Greg Imig and Amy DeWitt were charged with 8 counts, ranging from failure to obtain a burn permit to reckless endangerment when the origin of the fire was traced to a burning debris pile they left unattended in Willow in June of 2015. State and defendants' attorneys have attempted to negotiate an out-of-court settlement, filing motions and countermotions through the summer and fall. Assistant DA Senta says the state has collected a great deal of documented evidence in the case. The criminal counts against the defendants are all misdemeanors, but the extent of the damage caused by the fire is enormous. The fire swept more than 7,000 acres and destroyed 55 homes and close to another 50 outbuildings. No deaths were attributed to the fire, but it cost the state $8 million to fight the blaze. 2016 is on track to be the warmest year ever, according to an announcement this week by the World Meteorological Organization. If current trends continue, it would be the third straight year of record-breaking heat. That trend has been particularly noticeable in Alaska, where two-thirds of major weather stations have logged above normal temperatures every single month of 2016. Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Bretschneider told Energy Desk's Rachel Waldholtz that what we're seeing is unprecedented.
Well, first of all, it's been warm everywhere. I mean, from Barrow down to Juneau, over to Bethel, Fairbank, everyone's been way above normal. So, but if you had to pick out one spot, it would be the areas that are closest to the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. So those are areas that have been far above normal. For example, Homer has been, you know, more than 1.5 standard deviations above normal every month of 2016. There's only, I think, 6 stations globally that can say that. Places like Dutch Harbor have been above normal for over 3 consecutive years, every single month. Cold Bay, St. Paul, very, very similar. Fairbanks, or Anchorage, over 12 consecutive months. But so the farther you get to the Gulf of Alaska, the Bering Sea, the more dramatic the warmth has been.
And what is causing this sort of relentless warm temperatures?
Well, you got a couple things going on. One is globally, temperatures have been increasing for a number of decades. So we're starting with this higher baseline. And then we're coming off a near-record El Nino, which really kind of supercharged the atmosphere, added a lot of warmth from the oceans into the atmosphere. So that really kind of enhanced things. Although now we're in a La Nina, officially declared a few days ago, and we're still, you know, experiencing this unrelenting heat.
You know, I think the question for a lot of people is this the new normal? Is this what climate projections say we should be seeing right now, you know, with global warming, or is this a blip?
Probably some of both. There were really no long-term global climate models that said, hey, this was going to be happening this quick. So, but this is more of a 30, 40, 50 years down the line. That being said, these kind of warm episodes are going to be more likely with the increase in the baseline temperatures globally.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Rachel Waldholz from Alaska's Energy Desk. Do you have a climate question for Brian? Email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, and Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Adrian Wagner in Emonic, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization. From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.